Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jackie Leonard, and in the early hours of Monday, the 10th of February, these are our main stories. Millions of people in China are about to return to work after the Lunar New Year break that was extended due to the coronavirus. The Irish Nationalist Party Sinn Féin has demanded a role in the Dublin government after early election results indicated a breakthrough following decades on the fringes of politics. And thousands of mourners in Thailand have held a vigil for victims of a rogue soldier now known to have killed 29 people. Also in this podcast.
I love to sing. Now I must say that I am literally afraid more than when I have done my debut.
The Italian soprano Mirella Freni, who has died at the age of 84. Millions of people in China are preparing to go back to work after the Lunar New Year break, which was extended to try to curb the break of the new coronavirus. But many factories and offices have been ordered to stagger their working hours to limit the number of people in public places. The virus has claimed more than 800 lives in China, exceeding the number killed by the SARS outbreak nearly 20 years ago. Our Beijing correspondent John Sudworth has been gauging the mood in the capital.
It's Lantern Festival, traditionally marked with a lavish TV gala. But this year, there's not an audience member in sight. Every seat is empty. The fear of contagion is everywhere, with fever checkpoints at which temperatures are taken at almost every turn. And with China's army of migrants now returning to the cities after the extended Lunar New Year holiday, companies are being told to stagger their arrival and encourage those who can to work from home. But the UK ambassador to China, Dame Barbara Woodward, tells me the continued uncertainty means all Britons are still being advised to leave China.
We're currently seeing numbers of infections double every 4 to 5 days. We don't know what implications that has. We've seen the Chinese put in place local transport measures. Some cities and towns have been closed down, high-speed rail. So it's getting more difficult to leave China if that's what people plan to do.
We know that the evacuation flight has got out of Wuhan. Are we confident now that most people who wanted to get out from the epicentre have managed to?
We have not got everybody out, we know that. Unfortunately, two people failed temperature checks early this morning. They've had to go back into Wuhan, and we are in touch with them, and we'll try and support them to get them onto another country's flight.
The Lantern Festival has brought with it a glimmer of good news. Over the past 4 days, official figures suggest the rate of increase in infections may be slowing.
That report was by John Sudworth in China. The political landscape in Ireland has been transformed by a surge in support for the nationalist party Sinn Féin in the general election. Initial results appear to bear out Saturday night's exit poll, suggesting that the party's share of the popular vote matched that of its two biggest rivals, Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil. Sinn Féin's leader, Mary Lou MacDonald, said it was not sustainable for them to rule out going into coalition with her party. Our Ireland correspondent, Chris Page, has been at the main counting centre in Dublin.
While few results have been officially declared, Sinn Féin candidates are already celebrating what's set to be a huge breakthrough. For decades, two parties broadly in the political centre, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, have always been ahead of the rest. But the tallies at count centres are showing that three-party politics has arrived. Sinn Féin is in the running to take the most first preference votes. Because it's fielded fewer candidates than its rivals, it isn't likely to end up with most seats when the long and complex counting process is finished. No party is expected to win an overall majority in the Irish Parliament. Fine Gael, which is led by the Prime Minister Leo Varadkar, has ruled out going into coalition with Sinn Féin. So too has the leader of Fianna Fáil, Micheál Martin. The Sinn Féin president, Mary Lou MacDonald, said there'd been a revolution at the ballot box and her party supporters deserved a voice in government.
I do not accept
the exclusion or talk of excluding our party, a party that represents now almost a quarter of the electorate. I think that is fundamentally undemocratic.
During the campaign, Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil pointed to Sinn Féin's links to the IRA during the conflict in Northern Ireland, but Sinn Féin emphasised its role in the peace process, and its focus on left-wing economic policies seems to have worked. Counting will continue. Negotiations to form an administration will be anything but straightforward.
Chris Page in Ireland. Switzerland has had laws banning discrimination on the basis of race and religion since 1995. But until now, that protection has not been extended to gay, lesbian or bisexual people. On Sunday, though, Swiss voters took part in a referendum, and just over 63% of those who voted backed a move to do so, which is also supported by the government and most of the country's political parties. Anna Russenwasser, a director of the Swiss lesbian organisation, welcomed the result.
Today is an important day, not only that yes was voted, but a clear yes. It shows that Switzerland really stands behind gays, lesbians and bisexuals. And it also gives us momentum for the next one, which is marriage for all with the protection of all families.
Our correspondent Imogen Folks told us how the vote would affect the lives of the LGB community in Switzerland.
It means that under law, they will be protected against verbal and physical abuse and against discrimination. And I think the most important thing you need to take out of this thing is that the gay community says this will make a huge difference. In the run-up to this vote, they had pointed to a spate of attacks recently on openly gay couples. And they said, we need this sign. We need to feel protected and accepted in our own country. And today, and you heard Anna Rosenwasser there, they are very pleased, not just by the yes vote, but by the scale of the support. They weren't expecting over 60%. In the end, they got over 63%.
And what sort of opposition had there been? Obviously, it wasn't reflected in a vote, but what sort of resistance had there been to the change?
Well, the resistance was led largely by the right-wing Swiss People's Party and some evangelical Christian groups. They had two arguments to make. One, that the law would perhaps introduce censorship. People wouldn't be able to be free to express their own opinions in private conversation or to make off-colour jokes, if you like. And two, that particular churches who really, as they would put it, prioritise the marriage of a man and a woman would find themselves being asked to welcome same-sex couples. They argued that. Clearly, those arguments did not find favour. And again, the scale of the vote in favour of this new law shows, I think, that Swiss public opinion is really going in a very different direction nowadays.
So is there public support for same-sex marriage now?
Well, it's going through Parliament. It's, again, like this law, been recommended by the government and is going through Parliament. The indications are that, given today's vote, this will also find favour. But it may be that, once again, opponents will gather enough signatures to force the Swiss back to the ballot box to approve what their government and Parliament has already approved. So it could be that, you know, Parliament approves same-sex marriage, but we have to wait another couple of years for a referendum to prove it. But it's certainly coming.
That was Imogen Folks in Switzerland. Iran says it launched a satellite into space, but that it failed to reach orbit as planned. The country's space program is opposed by the United States, which believes it's a cover for the development of missiles. Alan Johnston reports.
The Iranians have talked of their success in managing to get the satellite into space, but they admit things didn't go as planned. The satellite didn't go into orbit, so the mission failed, just as Iran's previous attempt last year was also unsuccessful. But the Americans are still likely to be uneasy. They worry that the rockets Iran uses to hurl a satellite into space could be adapted to carry a nuclear warhead. The Iranians deny that they want to acquire atomic weapons.
Alan Johnston, and staying with space matters and to the sun. It is the source of life on Earth as well as a potential threat, but there's still plenty we don't know about it. In the early hours of Monday morning, a probe will be launched into space to get up close and personal with the beating heart of our solar system. The European Space Agency's Solar Orbiter will get close enough to take photos and detect the powerful storms that can suddenly flare up. Professor Mark McCorcoran of ESA has been telling James Menendez more.
One of the key things that we really don't understand about the sun is how it actually operates on the inside. That we know that there's nuclear fusion deep in the very core, and that heat and light then leaks out over hundreds of thousands of years. But there's also a very strong magnetic field in the sun, and that actually helps create a storm of particles, which then rise from the surface of the sun and impact the Earth days later. And that connection, what we call space weather, can impact electrical power stations. It can impact the way radio and TV and other things work. So it's quite a critical thing to understand. And the only way you can really do that is with this ESA and NASA solar orbiter, to go close enough to the sun to feel the solar wind streaming past the spacecraft before it all gets turbulent and messed up by the time it reaches the Earth. So it's quite a complex set of instruments on board, effectively, to study the sun up close and personal.
And how is it going to do that, given how destructive all that heat and energy can be? How is it going to get close enough without getting too close?
We'll be using the Earth and Venus to slingshot us closer into the centre of the solar system. That lets us get to within 42 million kilometres of the sun, roughly a quarter of the distance that we are here on the Earth. That then brings attendant issues with how hot it's going to be. It's going to be up to 500 degrees centigrade on one side of the spacecraft at the closest approach to the sun. On the other side, it's going to be minus 200 degrees because it's facing the cold of space. And that's a really complicated technical engineering challenge, which has taken us a long time to solve. Basically, it means a big heat shield on one side, which is isolating all the instruments and computers and electronics on the other side from the heat of the sun. And that's got some very interesting technology, which actually, strangely enough, involves charred animal bones, which have been embedded into the front surface of the heat shield so that it's extremely black, absorbs the heat, but is very robust against all the particles streaming from the sun. But it's a very complicated challenge, but hopefully we're there now. We've got everything ready. It's on top of the rocket in America and ready to go.
Professor Mark McCorcoran of the European Space Agency. Still to come in this podcast.
The fact is that this instrument is very rare. It's not like a guitar or a violin that you see in a shop and buy.
Mali has demanded compensation from the United States after accusing US customs of destroying a rare instrument belonging to a traditional musician. To Thailand now, and you will remember in the last edition of the Global News podcast, we were getting news of a mass shooting. Once it was over, we knew that 29 people were dead, and on Sunday, a vigil was held. The chanting of Buddhist monks who were among thousands who gathered in Nakhon Natcha Sima to honour those who were murdered in the shooting spree, which began at a military camp and ended at a huge shopping centre. More than 50 others were injured in the attack by an army officer. Our Asia-Pacific regional editor, Michael Bristow, told us more.
This vigil took place in the main square of Nakhon Ratcha Sima, where just 24 hours previously there'd been a scene of carnage, a real contrast. It was very calm. There was a stage where monks dressed in orange robes chanted prayers, and mostly people sat in front, thousands of people just listening. Some wrote down notes of condolences, some laid flowers, but many just sat there and listened in silence. And essentially what they wanted to do was come along and just express their horror at what had happened. And this is what a couple of them had to say.
In my opinion, I'm wondering how many people like this are living amongst us. I feel sorry. Everyone feels sorry.
In fact, in a Buddhist country, this kind of crisis should not have happened, not only in Korat, but in the whole of Thailand.
And what have we learnt, Mickey, about the motive of the gunman?
Well, we're still not sure of the exact details, but it appears that the gunman, a junior officer, a sergeant major, had had some kind of argument. He was involved in some kind of deal with his commanding officer, and there'd been an argument. It was about the sale of a house. And in fact, we believe that the commanding officer was one of the first people to be shot at a house where this gunman had gone to first of all. Earlier on Sunday, the Prime Minister of Thailand, Prayut Chan-o-cha, actually gave a few more details about the nature of this argument.
Since the incident, our investigations have found that the gunman had a personal conflict about an agent's fee in a land-buying business with his senior officer and his mother-in-law. They argued for 3 days. No one thought it would turn violent.
This incident lasted a full 18 hours before it was concluded, and there was an awful lot of uncertainty and long lulls while people tried to work out what was going to happen next. Just remind us how it was concluded.
Well, it was ended by Thai forces who managed to isolate the gunman in the basement of the shopping centre where he'd killed most people. It was in a supermarket. They managed to catch him. He fired back. They fired and killed him. But as you say, we're getting details now of the people who were, hundreds of people really, who were trapped inside the supermarket at the time this was going on, because of course they didn't know where the gunman was. They didn't know if it was safe to come out. So you've got stories of people barricading themselves inside toilets, ripping off toilet doors to close the main door, wedge it closed. You see videos of other people dashing into shops as shutters come down, other people locking themselves in storerooms, and as I say, not really knowing when to come out until they got word from the authorities. A lot of them got word over mobile phones that it was safe, say, on the first floor, so then they made it out and just fled as quickly as they possibly could.
That was Michael Bristow. As we record this podcast, much of Western Europe is being battered by a storm front that's been causing severe travel disruption. In Britain, this was the beginning of the lunchtime weather forecast on television.
Good afternoon. It can't have escaped your notice by now. The UK is taking a battering from Storm Ciara. The Met Office has an amber warning out for England and Wales for severe gales, and we're already seeing widespread disruption.
In the UK, winds gusting at up to 120 kilometres an hour brought trees down onto train tracks and power lines, causing cancellations and power cuts. Flights were cancelled in France, Belgium and the Netherlands. In Germany, where the storm is called Sabine, a high-speed rail network was halted. But the high winds proved to be a boon for one group of passengers early on Sunday morning. A British Airways flight from New York to London broke the record for the fastest subsonic flight across the Atlantic. It hurtled across the ocean, riding a powerful tailwind in just 4 hours and 56 minutes, more than an hour quicker than normal. James Menendez spoke to one of the passengers, David Redhill.
I had had a light dinner, and then I checked out the in-flight screen with the airline map to see where we were, and I was astonished. We were already two-thirds of the way over. I could discern that there was a slightly whooshy feeling, if that's a technical term. Felt a little bit like being on a roller coaster, or when you're coming out of a tunnel with the wind at your back. And I lay down for what felt like a few minutes, and then the lights came on and we were preparing to land. So it wasn't much of a snooze.
And what about when you did land? Did the captain have anything to say at that point?
Well, when we landed, it was quite evident that we had been on a rather extraordinary flight, because people were turning on their phones, looking at their watches, scratching their heads and looking puzzled. And then the captain came over the tannoy and said, yes, you'll be happy to know you've been part of the fastest transatlantic subsonic flight in history. And I said, what does that mean? And he came on and said, well, apart from Concorde, you've been on the fastest flight. It was a bit of a mumble, and then everyone started cheering. It was a round of applause. So everyone felt pretty chuffed. And as we trooped into the customs hall, one had the feeling that we were a little earlier than expected, because we caught them by surprise. I think we were 80 minutes faster than the normal flight. So it was really the start of Heathrow's day.
Yes, yeah, so everyone was sort of asleep, or probably hadn't got to their desks or their posts, had they, by that stage?
Yeah, exactly. I think people are also rechecking their boarding cards, no doubt, to keep them as mementos, because I think, you know, everyone likes being part of a world record. We're not all Usain Bolt. And if Larry from Parramatta or Glynis from Bognor Regis can be part of a world record, it's something to hold on to.
Every cloud, eh? That was David Redhill on the BA flight that now holds the record for the fastest subsonic flight across the Atlantic. The government of Mali has demanded compensation from the United States after a famous Malian musician accused US customs officers of destroying his traditional instrument, a kora. Balake Sissoko discovered it had been damaged beyond repair, as Richard Hamilton explains.
The kora is a 21-string traditional lute that has become archetypal of West Africa, and Balake Sissoko, playing here, is one of its greatest exponents. He had been on a tour of the United States, but when he landed in Paris last week, he opened his instrument case to find that the kora had been taken apart, with its neck, strings, bridge, and amplification system removed. He said he also found a note from customs agents saying intelligent security saves time. But he wondered if they would have dared dismantle a Stradivarius violin. He told the BBC his instrument was impossible to replace.
En fait, oui, l'instrument, c'est rare aussi, mais c'est pas comme...
The fact is that this instrument is very rare. It's not like a guitar or a violin that you see in a shop and buy. It's an instrument that was custom made and modified for me. I'm very, very angry about this because there's been absolutely no respect. When you see something like this, you must respect it.
The American Transportation Security Administration, or TSA, has denied its agents opened the case. But Mali's culture minister, Ndiaye Ramatoulaye Diallo, issued a statement saying the incident had caused immense cultural damage. She added that it was an unprovoked and sad act of aggression and a reflection of a kind of cultural ignorance and racism that she said is taking over in so many parts of the world.
That report by Richard Hamilton. As we record this podcast, the 92nd Oscar ceremony is getting underway in Los Angeles. The Academy Awards tend to be about glitz and glamour, but in recent years in America, choosing the best films, directors and performers has become caught up with much bigger issues, diversity and the representation of women, for example. Our arts correspondent Will Gompertz sat down with the legendary director Spike Lee. He was asked what he made of this year's Oscar nominations.
It wasn't like last year. And I said this last year that don't expect six African Americans to win Oscars next year. So it's a feast of famine, and it's going to be a struggle, and the struggle continues. So I'm happy to be here. I'm presented this year, and we'll see what happens.
Why is it a struggle? Why does it continue to be a struggle?
Because power does not give up power easily. It's from the Bible. I mean, you go way back. You know, power is not just give up power because somebody says can't be inequality. It doesn't happen like that.
If you're in charge...
that's a hypothetical question right there.
What would you do?
I think that what the Academy's doing now is that they're opening up the voters, the membership. The membership is much more diverse than it was way back. So it's not going to change overnight, but it's changing. And I think they're doing a good job. But it goes back more than Academy. It goes to the studios, the gatekeepers. These are the individuals that run and run it. They decide what movie we're making, who's the director, who's writing it, who's starring it. And we see more diversity amongst the gatekeepers then have a great effect amongst the Oscars.
And is it happening at the moment?
The gatekeepers?
Right.
No.
How do you change that?
Well, I think that it has to come down to dollars and cents, that the movie-going audience has become much more diverse. And if you do not serve this audience, you lose the money.
You know, when you walked out last year during the ceremony, where did you go?
I never left.
They said there was some story that I tried to leave, but they didn't let me. That did not happen. I went back, you know, and took a breath.
The awards are important.
They are. I mean, people's careers have been changed by awards. More money, more prestige, better scripts, all types of stuff. They're there. Here's the thing, though. Do you think these studios would spend the hundreds of millions of dollars they do on campaigns if they didn't matter?
Right.
This is a business. Hollywood is a business. Art doesn't always come ahead of business.
And what is that Hollywood business like at the moment, Spike? You know, post-Me Too and all the rest of it. Is it changing or is it same old, same old?
It's the same old thing. Maybe dressed up differently. What has changed is that filmmakers have more than one place to go.
Do you, as a filmmaker, somebody who's grown up, you know, imbued in the sense of going to a theatre to watch a movie, do you worry about the future of cinema in terms of that shared experience?
Yes, and Martin Scorsese, my friend, my mentor, we've talked about this. But you have to make difficult choices. My new film, The Five Bloods, had been turned down by all the studios. Netflix did it. It disturbs me very deeply when I see people watching my films on their phone.
Has it changed the way you think as a filmmaker, the sort of way you make a movie?
No.
Not at all?
No, I'm not. I'm shooting my film for cinemas, not for a screen on a phone. Not doing that. At least not yet.
The director Spike Lee speaking to our arts correspondent Will Gompertz. And finally, the world-famous Italian soprano Mirella Freni has died at the age of 84. She was born in Modena in 1935 and was a childhood friend of Luciano Pavarotti. Speaking to the BBC's Desert Island Disc programme in 1977, she said they had shared the same wet nurse in the tobacco factory where their mothers worked.
My mother and Pavarotti's mother, they worked together in the manufactory, like Carmen.
Yes,
and
yes.
And they are really, really, really friends. And sometimes I joke with Luciano. I said, Luciano, you drink too much milk.
Mirella Freni made her stage debut in Modena when she was just 19 in Bizet's opera Carmen. She was asked on Desert Island Discs whether she'd been nervous.
Not at all. Really, I wait the moment to go on the stage to sing, and I've had so many friends in gallery, you know, all the parents, all the friends, and they sent me many flowers. I was really excited, and I love it to sing. Now I must say that I am a little afraid more than when I've done my debut.
Freni went on to enjoy a long and successful career, singing a vast repertoire of roles from operas by Verdi, Puccini, Mozart and Tchaikovsky, until she retired in 2005 at the age of 70. Here she is, singing from Puccini's opera Gianni Schicchi. Voice of Mirella Freni, who has died aged 84. And that's it from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you'd like to comment on this one or the topics we've covered, do please send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Jackie Leonard. Until next time, goodbye.
Today, more people live in cities than outside of them, and by 2050, a whopping 70% of the world's population will be living in urban areas. Cities shape our lives, and they're only becoming more important. I'm Greg Lindsay, host of Brighter Talks, a new podcast series from Covestro that looks at ideas and innovations for our future cities. In each episode, we hear from architects, inventors, mobility directors, and more. Listen now and join us as we explore ideas for a brighter future.